This episode of the Citadel Cafe is brought to you by listeners like you. Visit patreon.com/thecitadelcafe to find out how you can become a patron and help make this show possible. This is the Citadel Cafe, episode number 367 for Tuesday, July 21st, 2020. My name is Joel Duggan, and the Citadel Cafe is where my friends and I hang out to talk about the geeky stuff that we are into. Joining me this week, Megan Townsend is back. You can find her at Megan Townsend on all the social media that matters. Hello, how is your summer going?
Oh, hello, it's going all right. How is yours?
All right is about where I sit as well.
Yeah.
There are things to always complain about, but there are also things to not complain about, like the reason we have had a lapse in the podcast last few weeks, mostly due to scheduling conflicts and just life being more complicated for a lot of people that podcast as hobbies, because obviously a lot of people are going back to work after the pandemic restrictions based on your area may or may not be lifted or changing, etc. So there's a lot of flux happening, I think. And I'm noticing it not just professionally, but also just friends, family, everybody seems to be super busy, all that kind of stuff. One other thing that will keep you busy is making small children. Lou and Erica, Lou, of course, busy zombie lord here on the server, welcomed Violet Elizabeth earlier this month to their house. Everybody's happy and healthy and home. But as a result, Lou has been sleep deprived and has not been podcasting. So as a regular co-host, we knew he was not going to be here in July. I was just unable to fill the spot. And I ultimately was just too busy and we ended up taking a couple of weeks off. But good news is that later on in the month, I've been speaking with Ryan Murphy from Zombies Ate My Podcast. You would also recall Ryan from, I think, episode 343 of the Citadel Cafe, the Christmas episode that we did. Talking about the last decade of geekiness, he was a guest on that as well. So he'll be popping in over the next couple weeks at some point to fill in Lou's shoes while Lou is helping Erica take care of Violet. But that's it for me. Busy is just the word of the month right now. But what have you been up to? What's new with you?
I've been really busy too, kind of just with my own stuff. Like, I'm back to starting work again, so I'm back on a normal, normal, quote unquote, as normal as retail can be.
Yeah.
But back on a work grind with work. But I did end up starting up a film mentorship, which I'm really excited about. There's a local organization in our city called Women in Film and Television. Or WIFT is our chapter. And it is specifically an organization for women who work in the film industry, as per the name. And it's like the one time Instagram has actually given me an ad that has been worthwhile, because I usually just scroll by ads. But it was just like, hey, so, you know, WIFT is doing this thing where, you know, there's a mentor match program. And I was like, okay. And I thought I'd missed it. Like, it kind of seemed like I'd missed the deadline for it. And I was like, I didn't. Okay. So I kind of just took some time and read it over. And it essentially is like, you know, they had 40 women who were offering, you know, their experience to, you know, people who were newcomers into the industry or who, you know, have worked in the industry much like I have, but don't really have much of a career in it yet and want to establish more of a career. So I honestly didn't think I would get it. But you had to like choose, you know, three women out of the 40, which was really difficult. I was serious about it. I was like, I had a spreadsheet, I had everyone's names and I had like their, you know, their specializations and it's like, all right, here's what I'm interested in and here's what I can, you know, what I could learn from them. And, you know, so like my problem is I'm interested in everything. So it was hard to narrow down exactly what I wanted to learn, but I'm really excited with the lady that I got. Her name is Margaret Harrison and she's a producer and she has produced live action and television, in film and television. And she also does animation as well. So hopefully I'll come out of it with a job.
Nice.
That's awesome. That's the goal. That's the hope. So we don't really know what it looks like yet, but.
Well, congratulations on getting the mentorship.
Thank you.
That's awesome.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm really jazzed about it.
And I know, I mean, obviously we've talked on the show before about your acting And we know we're all fans of animation here on the Sizzle Cafe.
Yeah.
Do you have like, I mean, or do you even know, I might be asking this prematurely, like, do you have interests in producing? Like, is that a role that you'd be interested
in?
Well,
one of the things I'd really like to do at some point is to be a showrunner, like run a show. So I feel like having a background in producing would be helpful with that. Yeah. So my experiences with film are mostly writing some directing my own stuff. Like, I have a really good visual idea of how I want things to look like. Oh, sorry, my keyboard just fell. I've never actually produced to the point where I've done scheduling, I've done budgets, I've done, a lot of the back end meeting stuff. It's usually more so on the creative side of things. And I think having a foundation in the business, more, you know, office-y department of producing would be really beneficial, especially in animation. Because I know how animation works. I know how animators work. I know that you need storyboards. I know that you need voice actors. There's voice directors, what have you. But a lot of the, the back end of like how you get from concept to production, I don't, especially in animation, I don't have a lot of experience with, like,
right.
what is the procedure for that? But also, like, you know, while I did go to film school for live action, I was often put in the positions of creativity. I was often, you know, this is unfortunate, but because I was the one girl in my class out of three girls who knew how to do makeup, I was always pigeonholed into, like, the makeup category. I was always pigeonholed into the art direction and wardrobe category, which I didn't mind, but I went to school to want to learn how to direct and write and produce, and right. I never got a chance to do that. So this is now an opportunity for me to learn that more, executive role of production that I wanted to learn but didn't get a chance to learn because I had a skill set that was recognized, and I'm glad that I was recognized for that skill set. But it's the most pigeonholed skill set for a woman in the film industry as a whole. Like, most women are makeup artists.
Right.
Like, you know, that's if you're a girl who knows even an iota of makeup skill, oh, we're just going to get you to do that all the time because no one else knows how to do it and no one else cares to learn.
Yeah.
Right. And that's, you know, because a lot of the dudes are just like, well, I want to be a director, so I'll just, you know, I'll let the girl do it. I don't think that was ever a conscious decision that anyone had made, but I do remember distinctly feeling like I got passed over for editing roles or directorial roles or any roles that involved the creative decisions. I was always subverted to be like, here's what my vision is, make it work. And I didn't like that. So I'm hoping that I can have a little, you know, learn how to kind of spearhead something a little bit more in terms of production. So
cool. Well, I mean, I'm sure your mentor will be able to shed a lot of light on things. And don't be afraid to reach out to me, too. I mean, I started my career in television animation and quickly moved from animating into production managing. So I didn't do any producing in animation in terms of the wheelings and dealings of money and clients. But I was definitely called on as the production manager to help come up with the production floor budget that was part of the overall project. Like, how many animators do we have? How long is it going to take? What are we paying them? What does that add up to? All that kind of stuff.
Right.
So I was working in that kind of stuff. And I've done a lot of creative production in terms of like storyboarding to keyframing to animation and like what those processes look like. It has been 15 years since I've worked in television animation. however, I still have friends that are animators. And from what I can tell, not much has changed, which is unfortunate in a lot of ways. So some of the information that I have, at least the bones of it, would be accurate. The nitty gritty has obviously changed. I'm sure the workflows and programs and everything has changed. But the general flow of things. I've never been involved in a project. I've provided artwork for projects that are in the pitch sort of session where they're not shows yet. The producer is still kind of shopping them around and they're in that kind of like early phase. I've provided artwork for stuff like that, but I'm always like contract for hire. Like, I'm not part of the team that's
pitching
it. You're
not part of the creative.
No, I'm not a showrunner. I'm just like, we need these character designs. Can you do this? Yes, I can. When do you need them by? Like, that kind of a thing. So I'm familiar with that kind of a process. But again, like, I'm usually in the creative side of things. Now, as far as like actual production and some of the other side of things, you know, for me, it's podcasting production, is something I've got, you know, 10 years in, And for that, and well, and I guess in book publishing, like that has very similar sort of like business hat executive kind of like you get to wear all the hats at the same time, the marketing hat, the production hat, the right. creative hat, like that kind of stuff. There is some overlap there, but I mean, obviously, you know, not nearly as specific. And someone that's working in the industry is going to have much better, much more up-to-date information. But if you ever need a quick hit and you think it's a simple question, then just let me know. I'll do my best.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Like, I'm really looking forward to hearing what you
Oh man, I'm so excited. Like we don't really know what it looks like yet. Cause there wasn't a lot of, this is the first time that Halifax has anything like this. Like this is the first time this is happening in Nova Scotia, especially with WIFT. I think there's a Toronto chapter of WIFT as well. And I believe that, the Toronto chapter has done something similar, whether or not it's through WIFT, but I know that there's a lot of mentorship opportunities in Toronto. No one really knows what this is supposed to look like. So it's a lot of trial and error and trying to figure out, you know, what works for everybody. Mm. We had a call last Tuesday of like with all the mentees, there's like 40 girls, 40 women who've, you know, been approved. And, you know, we had a call with all of them. And I think a lot of us are still kind of in the dark of, but like, they said it's going to be 9 months, but we only get 4 hours with our mentor. Like we have 4 1-hour sessions where we can ask all the questions we want. So I don't know if that's clear. That's kind of what it sounded like, but it doesn't sound accurate. trying to still figure out what it looks like. So I'm going to talk, you know, I think, you know, your mentor can, you know, I think me and my mentor are just going to figure out what works for us at the end of it. But
That's cool. That's very, very cool.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of animation from yesteryear, I made a note in our Discord a week or two ago, whenever it first was released, but the majority, if not all, of the Miyazaki films are now on Netflix. So mm-hmm. if you want to go back and watch some animation from all over the map, then it's available. And some of these I hadn't seen, some of these I hadn't seen in a very long time. And I was in the mood for something really chill over the weekend, and I started and eventually finished a couple days later watching Spirited Away from 2001. I didn't realize it was that old. I remember it being more recent than that. But it makes sense because it was all the rage when I was finishing up animation school, and that's about the time that it was released. And I remember watching it ages and ages ago and being a traditional Disney kid. Pixar was out and doing very well, and so you kind of have your fanboy moments. But I remember watching it and not really liking it, not dismissing it, but just saying like, that's not really for me. It's still really weird. I don't find it has a very solid throughput. A lot of it I can chalk up to cultural differences and the difference of storytelling between like a Japanese anime feature film and how North America and Disney does it and has done it for 60, 70 years. But it is a weird, weird film. It does have some very good classical animation in it. Like there's some points where there's a lot of like water or sludge or different textures and things have to move very differently because it's based in a spirit world, which is it's kind of hard to grasp at first, but after a little while into the film, you sort of kind of understand that it's kind of like this weird stopping point for spirits on the way, this bathhouse. And so as a bathhouse, it has all these weird memes of like, you know, the dirty guest and like the sludge that has to be cleaned away. And so there's all this different stuff that in back when you were doing everything by hand and everything was all the special effects were hand animated. My mind was just like, oh my gosh, like that's water and sludge and floating things in there. And it's just like the amount of work to keep track of that kind of stuff. My brain still kind of goes, wow, okay. Someone spent a month on this scene, you know? Mm-hmm. And so when there's some good animation in it, I can understand maybe why it got a lot of attention. But for me, the overall story, I think in a huge part was part of the dialogue. Just, it was so stilted. Like everything was just like, we are going to do this. And then this is going to happen. Let's go do this. Okay, now. And then you're just like, all right, fine. That just, what's the motivation though, besides you just telling everybody what to do? Like there's a lot of that happening. I give it props for the underlying moral of the story, not being beaten over your head like a Saturday special. It's nice that way. Have you seen it before? Have you seen Spirited Away?
I love Spirited Away. Okay. I think it's honestly, it's one of my favorite movies. And I think the reason I like it so much is that like it's Miyazaki is often considered the Japanese Disney. His mm-hmm. work is as beloved as Disney is.
Yeah. And this was distributed by Disney in North America.
Yes. Yeah. So I think what I like about Miyazaki is that he's not afraid to have things be sad. He's not afraid to have things end. Like there's not in a lot of his movies, there's not a lot of happy endings. And like, you know, Spirited Away, while it ends in the best way it can, it's still kind of sad ending. It's kind of bittersweet.
Yeah.
It is really bittersweet. Like, you know, and I think, like you said, like the cultural differences, I remember finding it really weird, but I remember it being so weird, but so fantastical. And I think I just sort of understood, listen, spirits are weird. They have weird rules and weird laws for no reason. And a lot of this is probably not explained a lot because I think that's just so permeated in Japanese culture.
Right.
That doesn't really have to be explained. Yeah. And then you have the issue of, oh, it's also being translated from Japanese into English. So there's probably some things that are lost in translation that it just doesn't make sense. So I kind of just, when I first watched it, I was 12, 13. Mm-hmm. I was a kid. So I remember first watching it and being like, ugh, this is weird. No Face scared the shit out of me.
Yeah.
Was very scary. But I think I kind of just like sat back and just took it and was just like, all right, this is just fantasy. And it just is.
Yeah.
And then I watched it again recently. And when I, you know, I thought of it more, like it is, I think, a majority of why it's kind of difficult to follow is mostly just because of the culture. But humans in the spirit world is typically not a good thing. Humans in the spirit world eventually end up losing their identity, which is what comes from, you know, her name being taken from her.
Yeah.
Where she's Sen and not Chihiro anymore. You know, eventually you start to forget who you are. If you're a human, you start to lose your humanity. But I think that's the thing that makes Chihiro is such a good heroine, is that she's not like super strong and she's not particularly smart, but she's just so genuine and she doesn't lose her humanity. She never loses it. She starts to forget who she is, but you know, as soon as someone reminds her of the fact that she's human, she's like, oh, okay, no, I remember everything again.
Yeah.
And I kind of like how it's not just, you know, presented as like, you know, a pretty package with a bow, like, you know, like Disney often does. I feel like Western animation has a really clear beginning, middle, and end formula.
Oh, absolutely. Hero's journey. Eastern European fairy tale. Like, it just they've definitely gone that route for sure.
It's got a really specific style that we have.
Yeah, the stuff that I found stilted about Spirited Away was I wouldn't say a lot of it was hinged on the dialogue, but I find some things that were done well were things like the underlying moral of the story, which is greed is bad, and mm-hmm. that's clear, but it's not beaten into you through dialogue and repetition, which is lovely. It's monsters and consequences, right? You know, like the frog gets eaten by No Face because he can't resist gold, you know, like, and it's just, it's freaky and weird, but it's like, it's very straightforward in that, like, you know, he's being punished because he's not thinking, you know, he's putting, his own greed ahead of everything else. And I think that a lot of the film kind of has that kind of a thing where any kind of less subtle morals are also in there, but as examples, not as any kind of like monologue, which is nice. But vice versa, at the end of the film, I found the underlying saving force, that true love is what's kind of saved the day and saved, I can't remember the dragon's name.
Haku.
The only indication that there is any love at all in the relationship between Haku and Chihiro is that someone says there is. You're painted through dialogue that that Haku is not to be trusted. Haku doesn't have a warm vibe about him. And I'll lay that at the feet of the voice actor. Like, I just, it's not the best. I enjoyed the voice acting for Chihiro, and several of the other characters actually were quite well voiced. But yeah, like, I just, the, for Haku, like, I just, there was no concern or empathy or anything. And in a lot of ways, you know, the way that they do the limited animation sometimes with characters in anime, it's just so, everything is so flat. There's so little expression in so many of the main characters' faces compared to someone that's really expressive, like Ibaba, who's this weird big-headed witch character.
Yeah.
But like, when she has like a panic expression, or she's grossed out by a smell, like, I mean, the expressions on her faces are hilarious. Like, it just, it's so,
yeah, they're really good. Top.
Really well done. But then when you get like some subtle stuff, like, sometimes it was pretty good with Chihiro and, like, you know, bad smells and different reactions, very human reactions, very subtle in some ways. But when it comes to subtle acting, because of the limited design I find in some of the main anime characters, I mean, like, Chihiro has one expression the entire film, and I'm not exaggerating. Like, he might raise an eyebrow at some point, but he has the exact same face the whole time. Like, it is.
Chihiro or Haku?
Sorry, I meant Haku.
Yeah.
Sorry. Chihiro is very expressive. She's fun. Main character and pretty good. But also, like, in terms of, like, you have to be paying attention to her voice acting to get any kind of concern. Like, she doesn't really, there's not a lot of subtlety. There's no, she's not falling in love with Haku. Like, just, you don't get that.
So here's the thing with Miyazaki, and I had to do some research on this, and I think I got it more when I was a kid, and I, watching it again, I was like, okay, I remember why this kind of hit me in the feels a whole lot. I think whenever we think of love, like North America, I think we just have this obsession with romantic love. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole point of this one is it doesn't have to be romantic. It doesn't have to be romantic in the sense of, like, you know, falling in love to be married someday. There are different types of love. And I think that's what I like about Miyazaki so much, is that love is never expressed the same way. Like, if you watch My Neighbor Totoro, it's the love between two sisters and their mom and their dad, like familial love. excuse me. Kiki's Delivery Service is like self-love, and like, you know, friend love, like you learn to be friends. And I think that Spirited Away is kind of like towing that line between romantic love, but also just agape love. Like, you know, it's also just unconditional love of, like, you know, that can't really be put into words.
Yeah. I mean, I get that. But my problem with that, it's just not communicated with the acting or the animation. It is a line of dialogue from Ibaba's sister, I think, or maybe.
I think I would disagree with that. Again, I think it's also a cultural thing, because typically, you know, love in Japan is not expressed with, like, grand gestures. It's very subtle, and it's a very cultural thing that like boys are typically a little colder to girls. They're not as gentle or tender. So those tender moments that you do see where he's, you know, giving her food and, like, you know, putting his arm around her and, you know, while she's crying, those are like explosions. Those are like, whoa, that's such an intimate thing to do, because in Japanese culture that is. So it does take a little bit of a different way of looking at it. It's very different from North American animation and North American storytelling, and I think that's an important distinction to make. Your concerns are valid, definitely. I think that watching it as a North American Caucasian person, it can be, a lot of it is lost in translation.
And might be, I am better translated these days too, you know, like compared to 20 years ago, right?
Exactly. And I think, you know, as a, you know, self-proclaimed, I was a huge anime nerd. I did so much research on Japan when I was younger. I was like a full-on weeb. So I straight up, I'm not even ashamed of it. This was like I was obsessed. It was a problem. So I did a lot of research on culture, but like I found that like the Japanese culture is like, you know, the modern culture is very, it's very different. It's very different. It's very intricate, but it's also kind of beautiful in its own way, in terms of like how relationships are expressed. So especially between like two children, who are essentially like teenagers, they're young kids. It is, I think it's the most intimate Miyazaki film in terms of romance, even though it's not the same type of romance that we're used to seeing. Immediately upon seeing her, he makes a huge sacrifice to sneak her in to the bathhouse. I think that's a huge act of devotion for someone like, presumably from our perspective, that he's just met. He constantly sneaks out, and a lot of people are just like, oh, you got to be careful about Haku, but he's constantly challenging this by, you know, trying to help her out in the ways he knows how. I feel like poor kid's been stunted. Haku's been stunted. Like, he's basically like, you know, a prisoner, and he's also a dragon. He's a spirit. He's not human. So he's trying to figure out how do I, you know, show that I care about this person in a way that she would understand. And, I think it definitely takes a different, it's very high art. It is very high art kind of film. You have to look. Yes. Yeah. It is a very, you do have to look at it in a very, you know, you can't take it at face value. And I think that's kind of the point. I think that's why I liked it so much. And also it just looks so pretty. It just looks weird. So good. Yeah, it's beautifully weird. It's beautifully weird.
And it turns out the sludge monster was like a river spirit, or I can't remember what it
river
was.
River spirit. Yeah. But, so it's a, you know, pollution.
But it was, like, just so weirdly animated, and like there's just so much going on in those scenes, and some of the character designs are just bananas, and like left field, like the radish spirit, like what on earth? Like,
it's just, I love the radish spirit.
It's basically
so much.
Just an excuse to draw a fat guy in a Speedo, right? Like, it's really
more or less.
But do so in a way that's comical and
it's like a sumo wrestler.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And just, but the juxtaposition of having like little teeny Chihiro in the elevator with the radished spirit was just really odd.
But also when he walks and his feet squeak.
Yes,
That kills me every time. It's just like
there's a lot of repetition. Like there's a lot of patterns and stuff like that. I do always find like, and this is something I've seen in many different anime, television shows, stuff that I've seen. You see it crop up in like Avatar The Last Airbender here and there, but like the secondary, tertiary background characters, they all tend to have the same sort of like motivation of profit, success, or greed. Like, and they're all just, you know, like the frogs in the background, and they tend to have like their character designs, whether it's meant to be a human or meant to be a human-like or frog-like spirit or whatever it is, in Spirited Away, in other animes, they always have larger mouths than they really feel comfortable, you know, having. They always are more outspoken. Like, they're just, it's this interesting kind of like, I'm also remembering that more often than not, they're men. There's this interesting pattern of cultural throughput that you start to see. It was not something I'd probably watch again anytime soon. To me, it was just an interesting diversion from other stuff. And the first time in a long time that I've finished anything on Netflix, which we'll get into in just a second. I still recommend it. Like, I still think that people should go check it out. And the breadth of the library of the Miyazaki films and the Studio Ghibli stuff that is now on Netflix, like, you, even if you don't like one, you are more than likely going to find something. The hard part, I think, that's going to be challenging for people, it's like, for example, I wanted to recommend this to my sister because she's got a kid that is starving for entertainment. And at the same time, it's just like, I don't know what the age cutoff is for this, because there's some creepy stuff. Like, it's not.
Yeah.
No, I mean, well, I say it's not gory, but like there's a part where Haku is bleeding all over the place as a dragon from inside.
It can be very scary.
Yeah. So it can be a little bit freaky if you don't understand what's going on. And
So she should definitely not watch Princess Mononoke.
Okay.
100% not.
Yeah, good to know.
You should, though. I would love to know your thoughts on
Another one that
Mononoke.
I've started that never finished. But that
really?
Was, yeah, but that, I don't think that was that I don't like it. I think it was that I just got distracted, or I just had to turn it off and never just got around to picking it back up again. Or when I went to, it was no longer available on the streaming service. But now that it is, it's on, it's bookmarked. It's on my list.
Yeah.
Another because one of my, one of the comic artists I really admire, Scotty Young, Princess Mononoke is one of his favorites. So
I love it. A couple of recommendations I have for Miyazaki films, if anyone is interested. My favorites are Kiki's Delivery Service. Andrea's daughter might like that one, actually, because it's very young. Like, she's 13, you know, she's a kid. She's got a black kid. She's a little witch, you know. It's cute, and it's not like, you know, scary witches or anything. It's purely just,
yeah,
you know, the sweet little girl who's, you know, kind of going on a, you know, a coming of age adventure. So it's really sweet. Castle in the Sky, I like. It is a little scarier. It's, you know, got more robots and more gun violence. Like, Kiki's is not really scary. It's more just like emotional. I think the scariest thing is like an accident, like a citywide accident that, you know, I don't want to spoil it if you haven't seen it, but Kiki's is very cute. That one has a bit more of like a clear storyline. It has like a more of a clear beginning, middle, and end. Castle in the Sky has more of a clear beginning, middle, and end. Princess Mononoke is more of a clear beginning, middle, and end.
The other one that I've seen, it's been a long time, but I did remember liking it, was Howl's Moving Castle.
I love Howl's Moving Castle. Yes, that one is not violent either. So, for, you know, probably good for kids, but it is, it can be a little scary. Howl can be a little scary.
Yeah, I remember some of the characters. It's a little darker. I wouldn't necessarily call it scary. It would be scary by what North American animation people would consider, like, you know, what everybody has been told this is scary. That's how I think Howl's Moving Castle would kind of come across.
Yeah. Yeah, but yeah. Kiki, Castle in the Sky, Howl's Moving Castle are some of my favorites. I haven't watched it yet, but apparently When Marnie Was There is really good. Apparently it's very sad, though. Mm. But it's probably the next one I'm going to watch. Tales of Arrietty. I actually watched that recently. It is so cute. Oh, dang, it's cute. Oh, no, it's really adorable. The music is wonderful. Very, very sweet. And I don't know. It's just, Arrietty, I think.
Cool. Right on.
I think. I don't remember. But it's very cute. When Marnie Was There. I think, yeah, Tales of Arrietty, Howl's Moving Castle, Castle in the Sky, Kiki. And I do recommend Princess Mononoke in general, but that one is quite dark. It is very dark. Oh, and Nausicaa, Valley of the Wind. I really like that one a lot, too. Nausicaa and Princess Mononoke are kind of similar. But Nausicaa is a little lighter. It's not as dark. And it's kind of more of like a sci-fi, whereas Princess Mononoke is more of like a Japanese historical fantasy.
Right.
But they both kind of have a similar message. Nausicaa is very big on like, it's got a really big environmental message, and that one was actually out in the 80s. But it looks so good even now. Like it still stands up with a lot of the older Miyazaki films. Like the style has been very consistent across all of the Miyazaki films. So if you're watching like even My Neighbor Totoro, which came out in like the 70s or something, and was dubbed in the 80s in English, it looks very similar to some of the newer, like, you know, early 2000s more recent, like Ponyo is. Oh, Ponyo is very cute too.
Yeah, I remember Ponyo coming out when I was working in animation, so I had finished school at that point, and it had come out. Again, that one I didn't see, but I heard enough from other people that have seen it and liked it, and I was like, it doesn't sound like it's really my thing. And it was one of those things where just, you're a busy young professional, it's like, I don't really have time to go to go see this. Over the last few weeks, I've also watched a couple of other things, and these are just kind of quick hits, some of which we've actually talked about on the Citadel Cafe before. I went back and I started watching some other Marvel stuff. I was watching things that you want a sense of nostalgia. You want a sense of like, I know how this is going to end. I know it's a good movie. I don't have to worry about whether or not this is going to stink. So I was watching like Captain America movies and things like that. But I also went back and watched some of my less viewed Marvel films like Iron Man 3, Deadpool 2, and Thor Ragnarok. And in that order, meh, still meh, was on my phone for Deadpool 2 for half of it. Thor Ragnarok, it loses me in parts, but it's still a really good film. Like, I still really enjoy Thor Ragnarok, but there's definitely parts when they're on the planet with Jeff Goldblum, I'm just like, well, whatever. I really don't care about rock guy talking about bug guts. So, like, I'll tune out. And there are some moments that I feel like they've mishandled, but overall, I still really enjoy Thor Ragnarok. Iron Man 3, I don't think we've ever talked about on the podcast before, and we won't start now. But Deadpool 2 and Thor Ragnarok, we've definitely talked about on the podcast. If you want to go look those up, you can search them on the website. I do a pretty good job of tagging everything. It's pretty easy to find. Also, the album art for the podcast episode will more than likely scream which topic you're going to be in there. Now, every once in a while, I like to throw out a couple of things that I start on Netflix, but ultimately bail on for whatever reason. I'll start with Tomb Raider from 2018 with Alicia Vikander. I like her. She's a good actor. I wish that this was a better movie, but there were two useless chase scenes in the first half an hour, and none of it had anything to do with tombs or Raiden. And I just didn't care. It did not seem at all interesting. I got bored really quickly. None of it seemed overly clever, and I just was not my thing, and so I very likely will not go back to it. I haven't heard anything really remarkable about it either. It struck me as something that was trying too hard to become a series, you know, trying to be the first of many, rather than just being a good film. They're trying to reestablish a new franchise, probably because of the weight that the IP has. I lost interest really quick. Now, the other one, which we
never saw it.
Yeah, the other one that we can talk about more in depth, because you have seen it, is The Old Guard. 2020, brand new, Charlize Theron, who I really like, has a neat twist on Immortals. Charlize Theron's character and a few others are all immortals that are trying to do good in the world. They're like a secret covert ops team that has, like, it's this mix of like machine guns and axes and swords and stuff. And they're all of various ages and they're very, very old. I bailed at the end of Act One, give or take, when the main character, I can't remember her name, Emily something?
Andromache.
Andy, that's what it is. And I saw this in your notes, and I did know this, that at some point these immortals, they just start to have wounds that don't heal. And so they realize that their time is coming to an end. Their next shot might kill them. But this happens to Andromache, and she decides to hide it from the group, at which point I rolled my eyes and I never came back to it, because I'm just like, I've seen this 100 times in any other action film or any other kind of like group film where someone is too proud to show that they're hurt. I was like, oh, really? We're going to do this again? And I just haven't gotten back to it. Now, my dad finished it. He seemed to like it. He said that I should finish it. We'll get into how you feel about it. But I thought the concept of it was really neat, though. It's a well-done film. It's, you know, cinematography and action, great action sequences. Like, this is the thing where, compared to Tomb Raider, the action sequences in this and the build up to them make sense, and
they're justified.
They have weight, and they establish a number of things. Like, they establish the plot where her crew has been misled into being captured and given a fake mission. They establish how the whole immortality thing works. And show you that they are immortal. And they also show off the different fighting styles and kind of gives you an idea. It's like, well, why is this guy using a broadsword? And then you realize later that he's from, like, the Crusades. And it's like, so that kind of stuff I thought was really deep. Like, the action sequences have depth in that way, which I like.
Mm-hmm.
It was more just the slow moments when it's like, oh, God, really? We're going to be talking about this again? Like, it started to feel... It has these hints of like these Hollywood blockbuster films. Like, now we're all going to talk and make jokes about the past. It's like, do we have to do this again? And so that I found a little bit tiresome. And ultimately, like I said before at the beginning of the show, I have had a fairly busy month. So I just kind of bailed on this and never got back to it. And ultimately, what ended up sticking around for me was watching Spirited Away. So, you know, it might be mood. It could be just the fact that the movie does have some tropes. But it was, at least for what I saw, well made, and I will watch Charlize Theron in just about anything, except for Mad Max, which was trash. But
look at her.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Okay. But she's a good actor. But yeah, she's also unbelievably attractive. But I also enjoy her acting, and I've seen her in comedies, and I've seen her in action films, and I've seen her in the last thing I saw her in actually was Atomic Blonde, which was amazing.
And actually, that's why I watched it with Colin, and that's why we watched it, because he was like, she was really good in Atomic Blonde, let's give this a try. I like Charlize Theron for action. So we did some research on it after we watched it, and Colin is just very well versed in comics. And he's like, I've heard of this comic. He never read it, but it is based off of a comic book. And I guess from what he found later is that the movie was basically made by the author of the comic.
Oh, okay.
Or at least with a lot of input. I don't know if he directed, but he did have a lot of input in it. So I think he did actually adapt the comic into a script. And that kind of, you know, is a problem in its own self, because, you know, sometimes comics just don't work as an adaptation unless it's sometimes. I say sometimes because obviously we've all watched Avengers and that was very successful. But this, it had a lot of, like, the long stretched out moments of dialogue felt like panels in a comic book, where you have one whole chapter of just, let's just get caught up on story. And that works better in comic form than I think it does in movie form. It was a lot of exposition. We did talk about why they suddenly stopped healing. I kind of liked, because Andromache is immediately coined as the oldest and the strongest of all of them. So having her be compromised in some way, I felt like was really obvious. It was not a surprise, but it was also kind of interesting. And, you know, her being like the de facto leader of this little group of immortals, you know, I kind of feel like if she's not leading them, none of the others really seem like they could be leaders. So it definitely, until Niall shows up. So it kind of feels like, you know, it makes the tension really, really high. There's a couple of scenes later. I agree with your dad. I think you should rewatch it, or like at least, you know, watch the second half.
I could pick up where I left off. It's only been a week. Like I would right. rewind 5 minutes and I would probably be there. I think the last thing that I remember was, I mean, it's not really a spoiler, but like it's end of the first act there. They raid the church that's supposed to be abandoned, and two of the now four immortals are captured, the two dudes. And the last thing I remember is the rich asshole whose eyes are too close together drugs them and knocks them out. That's all I remember.
Right.
And that's about where like I probably had to pause it to get up to like clear the table or put dishes in the, you know, sink or something, and then just never bother to turn it back on. Like just
right,
you know,
just right.
Because I remember,
makes sense.
But I do remember like almost audibly having like a ugh when she, you know, touches her shoulder that isn't healing, and then she covers it up with a new jacket. It's like, oh, come on.
Yeah,
you know, like
I mean, I mean, it's a trope for a reason.
Yeah, what I do, but
it's a trope for a reason.
To not dwell on it, but to put on something you talked about, her being a leader. I like the fact that while she is the leader, respected as the leader, looked up to as the leader, she is done with leading because emotionally she's not feeling like they're making a difference. The world is just too screwed up.
Yes.
And the three of them, now four of them, are just swimming upstream with, like, they're just not making a difference. And I like that emotional throughput, because I think there's a lot of people on the planet that kind of feel the same way. You know, like I just, it definitely has that throughput into reality without echoing exactly what's going on in the world. Like, you know,
exactly.
It has this nice kind of undertone of like, emotionally, I feel like it connects with how a lot of people are probably feeling right now.
Mm-hmm. I agree. I think the thing that got me though is like, they're always like, we're trying to do good, but all we ever see them do is shoot people. So
yeah,
I got to the point where I was just like, they're talking about doing good things, but they've just killed a bunch of men. Mm. They're all dead. And then it kind of becomes this moral conundrum where, like, the main bad guy is the head of a pharmaceutical company, and, you know, we already know Big Pharma is terrible, but he's trying to find and distribute a cure for cancer, which is a pretty admirable thing. I mean, his motivations are still money.
Right.
But, like, you know, he's trying to do something. And, you know, if the main moral issue is, you're immortal. Why haven't you surrendered yourself? You could probably cure all the diseases in the world. Right? And that's never something that they explored. And they're just like, well, we just can't do that. But why, though? They never actually explain why that's a thing they can't do. It's more just like, we just can't.
What I'm remembering is a comment to the effect of, the worst thing that you can do to us is lock us up. That's why we don't want to be captured. Because we can't die, that means that we could perpetually be there forever. And that's why this Andromache's former partner that they didn't kill, but then they put her in a iron sarcophagus and dropped her into the ocean, is perpetually dying and being reborn again, and as a form of like indefinite torture. So they don't do a good job of explaining that that's why they don't help humanity in that way, because, well, modern humanity would put them up in a lab and never let them out, right? And that would be the end of it.
Or they could just take a blood sample and test DNA.
Well, yes, but
without keeping them in a cage, right? Right. They can just like, I'll just donate some blood and here, test that. Yeah. I'm going to go do my thing. Bye.
But I mean,
call me if you need more.
The world greed would just, that probably isn't how it would operate. But also then there just wouldn't be a movie. You know, like that's true. You know, like it's one of those things that's where I find the movie starts to feel weak, where it's like, well, it doesn't happen that way because the script says so, and it doesn't happen that way because otherwise this movie just has no point if we don't have some sort of like arbitrary, you know, emotional reason why they don't help out. And I mean, they get away with all the killing because, I mean, well, the people that they kill for the most part that I saw were trying to capture them. So, okay, well, there's the reason for that. But the other thing was like the people that they were killing were like kidnapping 13-year-old girls in the middle of Africa, and it was like sex trafficking stuff that they were trying to stop. So they were killing bad people, or so they thought. Like that was the idea. And so, and the impression that you get from the early kind of introduction of this team that Andromache runs is that they go after bad people. You know, people that are doing some heinous stuff in the world that governments don't want to deal with or can't because it's across different country lines and it just doesn't work out that way. Because the operative that they work with is a former CIA guy, and it's basically like a CIA thing where the government of the U.S. couldn't get involved because of the political fallout, but they could hire this covert op thing to, you know, I mean, there's so many other action movies that start that way. Like you just kind of take it with a grain of salt and be like, yeah, okay. I mean, this is kind of, it's loose, but I'm on board to kind of at least see what happens. Mostly I wanted to watch Charlize Theron kick the snot out of people like a ballerina,
and you know,
which
what though,
fantastic.
She does in later parts, even when she's injured. It's awesome.
It's really creative.
Yes,
like she's like shooting somebody with one hand and like decapitating them with the other with a giant axe that she carries. Like
it's a cool design.
It's very comic booky. You know, like it has that kind of a feel to it. So there is a certain amount of like letting go of, you know, reality in terms of watching it. But this is the thing. I don't just want to watch action movies anymore. I have very little interest in them. That's why I like the Marvel movies so much, is because they introduce things like superpowers and magic and flying people, and just there's all kinds of cool stuff that throws a monkey wrench in there to make it fantasy, make it sci-fi, make it an escape.
Yeah.
And this has just enough that I was just like, well, it's not just another action movie. It's got some fantasy elements to it. I, you know, remember, I don't like them anymore, but I remember the Highlander films when I grew up. Like, I was one of my first introductions to that kind of an immortal, you know, storyline. And I remember liking them, you know, like I remember liking the idea of it and stuff like that. My dad thought the films were good. So, you know, like seeing that kind of stuff and knowing that that's a throughput of fantasy and things like that in the long run was one of the things that I, you know, went to it. I may still return to it. It's one of the things that I bailed on. I'll call it a soft bail. I'm not like done, but
okay, that's good. When I was reading your notes, I was just like, oh no, like don't totally bail.
Yeah.
But like it's got just enough. I was as much as it's kind of just like, ugh, like their time, it kind of just seems so hokey. It does a really good job of like introducing this really subtle tension to everything, because gunfights suddenly are a lot more realistic. With most other action films, when you have a gunfight, you chalk it up to, oh wow, these professional marksmen just must be really bad shots to not be able to hit the main hero who's just scrambling on a you know, a thing and is miraculously just not getting hit with bullets.
The stormtrooper problem. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, it's like, yeah, the, you know, stormtrooperitis or whatever it is, so stormtrooper syndrome. So this one kind of makes more sense because they do take hits. They're just able to jump back from it a little bit more efficiently than others because they're immortal. But it still kind of creates this tension in it because, like, well, is that shot going to be the one, though? Is that shot going to be the one that finally does them in? And then there is a period of time where, like, they're all protecting Andy because she is a valuable asset. You know, there's other things that happen, but she becomes a really valuable asset.
Right.
And, you know, so there's this, you know, tense thing where she's helping, but she's injured, but they need to protect her because she's injured. And if she takes a bullet, then she's gone. But if they take a bullet, is that the last bullet they can take before anything goes to south?
Right.
So there is a fight sequence that is really, really, not stressful, but very tense. Like I was a little tensed up watching it, and I was kind of like, ooh, I hope nothing bad happens, because it introduced enough of this, you know, caveat to be like, they're immortal, but
yeah, tense in a good way.
You never know.
Suspenseful.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
There we go. That's the one.
Yeah.
Suspenseful.
I love it when a film can do that. Like when you can be on the edge of your seat. I'm trying to remember the last time that happened. I wonder, it might have, you know, well, I remember distinctly, not the last season, but some of the seasons of Game of Thrones was edge of your chair. What is going to happen next? And in a good way, right? Because you cared about these characters, or you cared about what was going to happen next. Or this character was so unpredictable, you just had no sweet freaking clue what they were going to do. That's to bring to mind, that's the last time I felt like that. But there's certainly been some films, I think, in the last few years that I've seen that have had that kind of edge of your seat sort of thing. I remember feeling like that about Ex Machina as well, watching that, being very uneasy, but very uneasy in the, this is a really well-made movie. Like, you know, like I'm really, you know, I'm meant to feel this way. I'm not uncomfortable with the content. I'm being steered artistically in this direction emotionally. So cool. All right. Well, we'll have links to all the kind of stuff in the show notes so people can go and check out these films, or not check out these films as you see fit. There are an awful lot of Miyazaki films on Netflix, so go check
that
out. If you click on one and you'll just recommend three more, like you'll be able to find a number to add to your library to check out at a later date. That brings us into the Internet Minute, which is of course brought to you by you. The Citadel Cafe is 100% listener supported. If you're getting value out of the show, please consider putting a little bit of value back into it. You can become a member at patreon.com/thecitadelcafe, where you will get access to the member only Discord chat, where we talk about this kind of stuff and have different recommendations all week long. We do tend to add about one new patron per month. I'd always like to add one more. There's always room for another happy person in the Discord. But if you want to head over to patreon.com/thecitadelcafe, the rewards are all listed on the page there. You'll get access to behind the scenes episodes. They don't happen on a regular basis. They just kind of happen whenever we have time, but you'll get access to that. And that is kind of like where we have all that stuff, I guess, organized, is on the Patreon page. This week, I'm stealing my pick from Johnny from the Spawnchunks. He shared this in the Render Distance. We were talking about different resources for creativity and building in Minecraft. This is a Steam app called Townscaper by Oscar Stahlberg. It's, I guess, a game, but it's mostly a tool. I don't really know. It looks really fun. It is a city builder. It retails for $6.69 Canadian, or roughly $5 US. It's really well designed. It's really clean. It looks really fun. There's little bubbly animations and a little sound effects as you build your city. And basically, it's just a point and click city builder. And it all kind of connects aesthetically based on what you've built already. So if you build a house and then you click on it again, it becomes a tower. And if you click on it again next to it, it becomes a long, narrow house. And then it becomes a castle. And like, you just basically click and see what happens. And you can punch holes in things. When you remove part of a walkway, stairs automatically come in. Like, you'd have to watch the video trailer that we'll have linked in the show notes to really understand it. But for people that are doing things like tabletop adventures, where you need to have a map of a city and you maybe want to have a bit of a 3D idea, for artists that want to do some quick city design, I've seen some situations where people have downloaded this tool, created a city, zoomed in to street level and taken a screenshot and then gone into Photoshop and painted over it. So all like a number of your design decisions are kind of randomly made for you, which is really kind of cool. And then obviously for Minecraft, if you're building towns and cityscapes and stuff in Minecraft, and you have streets to plan and buildings to mess around with. One of the problems that we found in Minecraft when people get overwhelmed by inspiration is that it's a block by block game. Everything you do has an intention behind it. Whereas in this kind of tool, one click equals a building, not a block, not a corner block of the building, but the entire building just kind of goes boop and appears. And
oh wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the thing with this is that it gets you past that initial roadblock, pardon the pun, of what to do next. Like with Minecraft, it takes a half an hour, 20 minutes to build a house, you know, to kind of like, do I like this? Do I like this here? Do I like the way that this is going to look? Whereas with this, we're talking seconds to decide, do I want to build a row of houses? Do I want to build a row of towers? Do I want a castle? Do I want a wall? Do I want a moat? It's all happening very, very quickly. And it's a matter of clicking or clicking away. So you can add and delete kind of like as fast as you can think to do it. And what I like so much about the modules in Townscaper is that it makes it look aesthetically like you've designed it that way as best as it can. Like, you're going to get some randomness. Like, you're not always going to get what you want when you click, but that's kind of the point. The point is not to create something precise, but to create a blueprint of something that you can then build off of and use for other things, I think. And it's really, really neat. It's again, hard to explain in an audio podcast, but we'll have a link to Townscaper and to Oscar Stahlberg's Twitter account as well in the show notes. So you guys should go check it out. That wraps up this episode of the Citadel Cafe. You can get more information about the show and links to some of the things that Megan and I talked about at thecitadelcafe.com. Music for the show was composed by Kevin MacLeod. You can email us at thecitadelcafe@gmail.com and let us know your favorite Miyazaki film. Follow the show on Twitter by name. And of course, subscribe on iTunes, Android, Stitcher, Spotify, and YouTube. We're everywhere. Super easy to find. Word of mouth, however, is the easiest way to support the show. Just tell a friend that they should listen to the Citadel Cafe and where they should find it. You can leave a star review on the Apple Podcasts app or your favorite podcast platform of choice. That also helps. My name is Joel Duggan. You can find everything I am doing online, including my illustration and design portfolio, at joelduggan.com. You can listen to The Spawn Chunks, my podcast all about Minecraft, at thespawnchunks.com. That had a new episode come out yesterday. And you can follow me at Joel Duggan on social media. I am super easy to find. But I will, of course, point you towards twitch.tv/joelduggan, where I am playing Minecraft, Satisfactory, and fingers crossed this week, Borderlands 3. We'll see what's going on. Megan, where can people find you online?
People can find me on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Twitch at Megan Townsend, but mostly these days on Twitch, where I just make a disastrous fool of myself. So if you like to laugh at fun, stupid stuff, come find me there.
You've been listening to The Citadel Cafe, where we are fast, easy, and cheap, but you can only pick two.